and talk too much and try to accomplish too many tasks in a day. Ones with a two-wing tend to have more rapid pace of speech, and because of it, they quickly transition from teaching to preaching. Under the influence of two, ones will more readily sense other people's needs. Unlike twos, however, they don't feel an irrepressible urge to meet those needs. So now let's talk about ones with a nine wing. Ones with a nine wing tend to be more introverted, detached, and relaxed. More idealistic and objective, they are often more circumspect, thinking before they speak to avoid saying something wrong or erroneous. They will pause before finishing a thought. Ones with a nine wing are outwardly more calm and mull over decisions for a long time. This wing exacerbates rather than helps the one with procrastination. The laid-back, easygoing stance of a one with a nine wing helps in building and maintaining relationships. Without the influence of the nine, ones tend to have too many expectations for others. So when they feel let down, the result is often resentment. The thing that is really hard and really amazing is giving up on being perfect and beginning the work of becoming yourself. Author Anna Quinlan. Stress and security. In stress, ones instinctively take on the not-so-great qualities we'd expect to see in unhealthy fours, the individualists. Their inner critic begins working overtime, and their need to perfect the world goes into overdrive. They become more resentful of others having fun, more sensitive to criticism, and depressed. In this space, they long to be free of obligations and responsibilities. They kind of lose confidence and they feel unlovable. But when secure, ones take on the great qualities we associate with healthy sevens, the enthusiasts, where they're more self-accepting, spontaneous, fun, open to trying new things, and being both and rather than either or. Here, the voice of their inner critic gets quieter. They're not as hard on themselves, and they shift their attention from what's wrong about the world to what's good and right about it. This move to seven insecurity often happens when ones are away from home and feel less responsible for improving or fixing things. Listen, I can tell you from experience, ones can become entirely different people when they go somewhere for a week of fun in the sun. And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good. Author John Steinbeck. Spiritual transformation. If you're a one, you believe the only way you'll know peace on the inside is if you perfect everything on the outside. And listen, it's not true. That tranquility only comes when you surrender your compulsive need for perfection and stop stifling your emotions, particularly your anger. Don't hide your true self behind that veneer of perceived perfection. Listen to me closely. A person does not need to be perfect to be good. That's worth repeating several times a day until it gets deep down into your marrow. A one's journey toward wholeness will have to include befriending their inner critic. As our Enneagram 1 friend Richard Rohr says, what you resist persists, which in this case means that ones shouldn't bother telling their inner critic to shut up, as it only gives it more power. Many ones say it helps to give the critic a funny name, so when it goes on the attack, they can say something to it like, Cruella, thanks for helping me navigate the world as a kid, but as an adult, I don't need your help anymore. Or ones might simply laugh and tell Nurse Ratchet to turn down the volume. Ones do well to remember there's more than one right way of doing things. Serenity means live and let live. Life isn't always either or, black or white, right or left. Brené Brown sums up the healing message ones need to hear. You're imperfect, and you're wired for struggle, but you are worthy of love and belonging. It's so often quoted, it's threadbare, but I can't resist mentioning the chorus to Leonard Cohen's song Anthem, because I think it was written for ones. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. 10 paths to transformation for ones. 1. To awaken self-compassion, try to capture in a journal the typical things your inner critic says to you and then read them aloud. 2. When your inner critic activates, smile and tell it you hear it and appreciate how it's trying to help you improve or avoid making mistakes, but you're taking a new path to self-acceptance in life. 3. Resist the urge to give other people to-do lists or to redo their tasks if you think they haven't met your standards. Instead, catch the people you love doing things right, and then tell them how much you appreciate them for it. 4. When you're ready to dive right in to correct an injustice or right a wrong, first ask yourself whether the passion you feel for that issue is really misplaced anger about something else. 5. Let your 7 and 9 friends help you learn how to relax and have fun. The work will still be there tomorrow. 6. If you find yourself procrastinating, think about the reason why. Are you reluctant to get going on a task or project because you're afraid you won't be able to accomplish it perfectly? 7. Pick up a hobby you enjoy but are not especially good at doing, and just do it for the love of it. 8. Forgive yourself and others for mistakes. Listen, everyone makes them. 9. See whether you can catch yourself measuring yourself against others to see who does a better job, works harder, or meets your definition of success. 10. Be aware of how you receive criticism from others and try to accept it without being defensive. Chapter 6, Type 2, The Helper. I want you to be happy, but I want to be the reason. Unknown. So here are a few statements twos might use to describe themselves. 1. When it comes to taking care of others, I don't know how or when to say no. 2. I'm a great listener, and I remember the stories that make up people's lives. 3. I am anxious to overcome misunderstandings in a relationship. 4. I feel drawn to influential or powerful people. 5. People think I'm psychic because I usually know what other people need or want. 6. Even people I don't know well share deep stuff about their lives with me. 7. It seems like people who love me should already know what I need. 8. I need to be acknowledged and appreciated for my contributions. 9. I'm more comfortable giving than receiving. 10. I like my home to feel like a safe and welcoming place for family and others. 11. I care a great deal about what people think of me. 12. I want other people to think I love everyone, even though I don't. 13. I like it when the people who love me do something unexpected for me. 14. Lots of people ask me for help, and it makes me feel valuable. 15. When people ask me what I need, I have no idea how to answer. 16. When I'm tired, I often feel like people take me for granted. 17. People say my emotions can feel over the top. 18. I feel angry and conflicted when my needs conflict with others. 19. Sometimes it's hard for me to watch movies because I find it almost unbearable to see people suffer. 20. I worry a lot about being forgiven when I make mistakes. Now let me tell you what healthy twos look like. Healthy twos can often name their own needs and feelings without fear of losing relationships. They're generous in their efforts to love well and care for others. These happy, secure twos also have appropriate boundaries, knowing what's theirs to do and what is not. They create a comfortable, safe space for others and are often considered to be a friend to many. Loving and lovable, they adapt well to changing circumstances and are aware of the true self that exists beyond their relationships. Now, average twos are convinced that the expression of their own needs and feelings will automatically threaten the stability of their relationships. They're generous people, but they often consciously or subconsciously expect something in return for their efforts. They have poor boundaries and generally only know themselves in relation to other people. They're attracted to powerful people whom they expect to define them, and they'll use flattery to pull them in. And unhealthy twos? They're codependent in their desire to be loved. They will accept almost any substitute, you know, like appreciation, neediness, companionship, and purely utilitarian relationships. These twos are insecure, manipulative, and often play the role of the martyr. They don't give so much as invest, trying to earn love by meeting others' needs, but always expecting a high return on that investment. After seminary, I accepted a job at a congregational church in Greenwich, Connecticut. To get to know the community, I went to a luncheon for local clergy where I met Jim, a Baptist minister from a neighboring town. Both Jim and I were young, new dads, and secretly beginning to wonder whether deciding to go into ministry was like, you know, deciding to get a tattoo when you're drunk, something we should have thought through a little more carefully. Desperate for support, Jim and I agreed to meet once a month for breakfast at a diner to debrief the previous day's worship services and talk about the victories and vicissitudes of serving churches. We became fast friends. One Monday, Jim and I pulled into the parking lot of the diner for our standing breakfast appointment at the same time. And to my surprise, he was driving a brand new Chevy Suburban. I chuckled as I watched him try to finesse it into a space. I mean, it was more like watching someone dock a Carnival cruise ship than park a car. "That's a nice ride for an associate pastor," I said to Jim as he climbed out and hit the lock button on his key fob. "Did you get a raise?" "It's a long story," he sighed, shaking his head. "I can't wait to hear it," I said, holding open the diner door for him. Over coffee and Greek omelets, Jim told me how he and his wife Karen became proud owners of a Suburban. The story involved a successful middle-aged realtor named Gloria, who was a beloved and active member of his congregation. Chatty, warm, and unconscionably cheerful, Gloria knew how to make everyone feel like they were her best friend. She hosted a popular Bible study for high school girls, who she encouraged to stop by her home or call at any hour if they needed a shoulder to cry on. She volunteered for everything, from teaching vacation Bible school to coaching the local softball team. Now, a few weeks earlier, Jim had been driving his twin girls to preschool in his old Nissan Sentra when Gloria pulled up in the lane adjacent to him at a red light. When she realized Jim was in the car next to hers, she honked and waved at him, made funny faces, and blew kisses at the girls. And when the light turned green, Jim waved goodbye to Gloria and drove off. As he did, he glanced in his side-view mirror and caught a glimpse of Gloria eyeing his car with the kind of expression one normally reserves for looking at a box of abandoned puppies. To be fair, Gloria had reason to be concerned about the structural integrity of Jim's car. Jim's 10-year-old Sentra was a testimony to the power of duct tape and prayer. The car's body was dented and dinged from bumper to bumper, and the muffler, affixed to the car's undercarriage with a coat hanger, roared like the engine of an F-15. The following Sunday, Jim and his family arrived home from church to find Gloria in their driveway. She was clapping her hands and bouncing on her toes like a sugar-jacked college cheerleader next to a brand new Chevy Suburban with a giant red bow on the hood. Jim and Karen wondered whether they were at the right house or had taken a wrong turn and accidentally driven on to the set of The Price is Right. They were still unbuckling their seatbelts when Gloria rushed at them, jabbering so fast it sounded like she was speaking in tongues. She hugged Jim when he got out of the car and told him how he was the best associate pastor the church had ever had. And then, wiping away tears, she ran to the other side of the car, threw her arms around Karen, and gushed on and on about how she was the model of a pastor's wife. Soon, the twins were out of their car seats and dancing around the new Suburban like Israelites around the golden calf, while Gloria explained how seeing Jim at the stoplight in his old Sentra had broken her heart and made her anxious for his family's safety. She just knew they needed a new car, but probably couldn't afford to buy one on a pastor's salary. So she felt moved to buy one for them. Jim and Karen were speechless. There was something about this transaction that gave them that uh-oh feeling. They tried to find words both to, express their gratitude and to voice their concern about accepting such an extravagant gift. But Gloria wouldn't take no for an answer. "Jim, I'm blessed to be a blessing," she said, pressing the keys to the new car into his palm. "I know Gloria meant well," Jim said to me, "but I'm telling you, that car's cursed. The rest of the pastors at church are grumbling because no one's ever given them a car. Karen won't drive it because she can't see over the steering wheel, and it eats more gas than an aircraft carrier." "Well, can't you tell Gloria it's not working out and return it?" I said. Jim shook his head. "Are you kidding? Every time I see her, she asks if we still love the Suburban and if she can do anything else to help us." "I've got a strong hunch Gloria is a 2 on the Enneagram." The 2's deadly sin. 2's are some of the most caring, kind, supportive, upbeat, and tender-hearted people on God's good green earth. 3 of my closest friends are 2's, one of which is my co-author, Suzanne, and together they radiate enough love and generosity of spirit to heat a metroplex. 2's are the first responders in a crisis and the last to leave a dinner party if there are still dishes to wash. In Enneagram speak, they're called the helpers. Now, if you suspect you might be a 2, then sit down, grab a box of Kleenex, light a scented candle, and take a few deep breaths before you read the next few paragraphs. Of all the numbers on the Enneagram, twos are the most sensitive to criticism. So you'll have to take my word for it when I say, this ends well. Twos, threes, and fours compose the feeling or heart triad and represent the most emotion-oriented, relationship-centered, and image-conscious numbers on the Enneagram. All three of these types believe they can't be loved for who they are, so each projects a false image they believe will win the approval of others. Twos need to be needed. They rely on other people needing them to bolster their fluctuating self-worth. Presenting a cheerful, likable image and helping others is their strategy for earning love. For twos, words of appreciation border on the intoxicating. Expressions of gratitude like, "What would I do without you?" or "You're a lifesaver." Make a two feel good. I'm talking Justin Bieber just retweeted me good. Pride is the deadly sin of the two. Which sounds nonsensical because twos appear to be more selfless than self-inflated. But pride lingers in the shadows of twos' hearts. It reveals itself in the way they focus all their attention and energy on meeting the needs of others, while at the same time giving the impression they have no needs of their own. The sin of pride comes into play in the way twos believe other people are more needy than they are, and that they alone know best what others require. They relish in the myth of their own indispensability. Twos are indiscriminate caregivers. They foist their assistance and advice on those they deem to be weaker, less experienced, and less capable of managing their lives than they are. People who would otherwise be lost without them. And you know what? It's hard not to pat yourself on the back when you have an almost supernatural gift for detecting what others need and a seemingly unlimited supply of time, energy, treasure, and talent to rescue them. Twos love to jump on their white horse to save the day when others require their assistance. But they can't imagine asking someone to lend them a hand when the situation is reversed. Twos rarely ask for help, at least not directly, and they don't know how to receive it when it's offered. It makes sense to twos that others have to rely on them, but for them to rely on others? Never in a million years. Not to put too fine a point on it, but twos suffer from an inflated view of their own power, independence, and value to others. What lies beneath that pride? Terror. Twos fear that acknowledging their wants will end in humiliation, and that directly asking someone to fulfill their needs will lead to rejection. They think, what if the person refuses me? How would I survive the shame and humiliation? It would only confirm what I've known all along. I'm unworthy of love. Though they're not always conscious of it, the help unevolved twos provide others comes with strings attached. They want something in return. Love, appreciation, attention, and the unspoken promise of future emotional and material support. You see, their giving is calculated and manipulative. Twos think if they can wrest appreciation and approval and evoke a feeling of indebtedness in others, then others will sense when they require help and provide for their needs without their having to ask for it. Unconsciously, they're drawing up a kind of quid pro quo arrangement. I'll be there for you as long as you promise to be there for me without my having to acknowledge or ask you for help. Twos believe they live in a world in which you have to be needed before you can be loved, and where you have to give to get. And because they don't believe you'd keep them around if they ever failed to render you service, twos find it hard to put a cap on the time and energy they'll devote to taking care of you. It's a wonder to behold when you see an immature two behind the wheel of the love train. Once it leaves the station, it's all but impossible to stop it. All about twos or helpers. Twos have an amazing way of making other people feel safe and comfortable. The moment you walk into my pal Suzanne's home, you feel like you've landed on an island of calm in a crazy world. I mean, it's filled with giant cushioned chairs, bowls of mini Godiva chocolates, votive candles, sacred art hanging on the walls, and Henry Nouwen and Mary Oliver books thoughtfully placed on side tables for guests to read at their leisure. I mean, it feels like a cross between the Ritz-Carlton and a Catholic retreat center. Twos accept you just as you are. They're not judgmental, and they create a space, both physically and emotionally, in which people can speak from their hearts and experience. On the other hand, as Richard Rohr says, twos are always on the make. That's because twos live in a tit-for-tat world. Whether through charm, flattery, crafting a likable image, or bald-faced people-pleasing, twos are always trying to seduce or entice people because they don't believe others will be there for them when they need it unless they keep up this cheerful and fawning exterior. Average twos are unaware that there are unstated expectations and ulterior motives behind their helping behaviors. They see the acts of service they perform for us as generous and unselfish, not based on the unspoken assumption we will reciprocate. They don't wake up in the morning and say to themselves, "Gee, my friend Janet is swamped at work. To earn her expressions of approval and affection, and to ensure that she's there for me when I need her, I'm going to leave a casserole and a bag of Hershey's Kisses on her doorstep." It's not until the following week, when the tables are turned, and the now overworked two is seething with resentment because neither Janet nor any of the other ingrates she's helped in the past brought her a casserole, that the two's true motives are revealed. When twos get healthy, however, they can recognize what's happening and compassionately say to themselves, "Oh no, I did it again. I expected that to come back in kind, and it didn't. I need to keep working on that." When twos walk into a room full of people, their attention immediately goes to, "How are you doing? What do you need? And what are you feeling? Oh, and most importantly, what do you want?" They are so attuned and responsive to other people's pain, you'd sometimes think they're psychic. This is an example of how what's best about your number is also what's worst about your number. It's great to have the gift of being attuned to other people's needs and helping them, but it's never good when a two or any other number leverages their superpower to manipulate people to give them what they want. Because their self-worth depends on the response they receive from others, twos always end up giving away too much power to other people. When my two friend Michael was first married, he wanted to express his appreciation to his wife, Amy, for working two jobs to keep them financially afloat while he was in grad school. So while she was still at the office, Michael cleaned the house, set up a card table with candles and a pot of her favorite herbal tea, and stuck post-its all over the house with love messages written on them. Distracted and tired when she arrived home, Amy, who, by the way, is not a two, walked right past the table without noticing it. A full 2 hours went by before she saw it and said, "Oh, are those flowers for me?" But by then, it was too late. Michael, had already worked up a head of steam and was oozing resentment. He had spent hours putting together this surprise, and his miserable wife hadn't even noticed. The night ended with their having an enormous fight over Amy's lack of appreciation for Michael. The next day, I realized I hadn't just wanted Amy's appreciation, Mike said. I had wanted her to fall at my feet and venerate me as though I were the patron saint of selfless giving. Later in our marriage, I realized how my self-esteem was tied to the way Amy and others responded to my being a helper. And that's a lot of power to give away. Twos are always on the lookout for signs of whether other people appreciate them. My friend Reynolds, a two, is a brilliant author and speaker. He once told me that for him, public speaking is a nightmare. I would always lock in on the crowd's response, he said. Whenever I was in front of a group of people, I felt like I had a 3x5 card taped to my forehead with the words, "Do you love me yet?" written on it. Inevitably, my helper antennae would pick up the negative signals emanating from the one vaguely unhappy-looking audience member, and I would do everything but stand on my head to please them. When nothing I did elicited that all-important look of approval and appreciation, I would leave feeling like a failure. Twos are afraid people will ditch them once they can stand on their own two feet. Suzanne is the mother of four great kids who adore her. From the day they were born, she has enjoyed a close relationship with all of them. But for the longest time, she was sure they wouldn't want to hang out with her once they were grown up and married. She had always thought, once they're done needing me, they'll be gone. What twos don't know is that people don't have to need them every second of the day to still want them in their lives. Twos can walk into a party and intuit which couple had a fight on the way over, who would rather be home watching baseball, and which person is anxious about losing her job. They can sense what other people are feeling without asking for a show of hands. The talk style of the two is help and advice. So much as hint that you need something and an immature two will chime in with quote-unquote helpful suggestions or their plan to help you. The problem is that not everybody at the party wants a helper getting all up in their business. Twos have to learn how to practice discernment. But before they leap into action like a Labrador retriever galumphing into the ocean to rescue a drowning child, they have to ask themselves, is this mine to do? If someone is actually drowning, dive in to help him. Otherwise, opt for restraint. Average twos tell Suzanne and me they have the ability to sense and then fulfill the needs of others. The key word here is sense. You see, you don't have to tell twos what you require. They just know. The problem is they assume everyone has the same ability to sense other people's inner life as well. This can lead to arguments that begin with someone throwing his hands up in the air and saying, "I'm not a mind reader. How was I supposed to know what you wanted?" And ends with the two storming out of a room, yelling over her shoulder, "I'm tired of having to tell you what I need when you should just know." For a two, feeling out of gas is frightening, because their self-worth relies on the continual supply of gratitude and appreciation they get from others for taking care of them. If they're spent, they won't be able to give. And then what use are they? At this point, a burnt-out two might have an outburst because they feel taken for granted. When it happens, it's like watching a satellite burning on re-entry into the atmosphere. My co-author Suzanne is a consummate two. As a speaker and a pastor's wife, she gets lots of opportunities to be a helper. Maybe too many. This is what it sounds like when she comes home feeling fed up and fried and walks into the kitchen where Joe is cleaning up. "How are you?" Joe asks. "Done." "Done with what?" "Everything. Nobody appreciates me. People count on me to give, 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 and they don't even thank me. Now everyone's doing great, and I'm spent. In fact, everyone I do things for is feeling so great right now, I bet they're probably having a party and forgot to invite me." For the next few hours, Suzanne will slam doors, hand Joe her church membership resignation because the leaders of the church have not once thanked her for teaching thousands of Sunday school classes, or threatened to get their kids on a conference call to ask why they never once expressed their gratitude for all the years she woke up early to press their school clothes. At their best, twos are warm and generous, like Mother Teresa or Archbishop Desmond Tutu or Princess Diana. But let me tell you, at their worst, they're resentful martyrs. Twos as children. Kids who compulsively want to please everyone are probably twos. As kids, twos are usually sociable and have close friendships. But because they're worried that no one is going to want them, they will try to buy or maintain love by giving away a favorite toy or their lunch. Unusually sensitive, these kids wear their hearts on their sleeves. Sometimes there's a hint of sadness about them because they don't see themselves as lovable. Once they learn that being helpful can earn a smile and praise, they'll be the first to volunteer to help their soccer coach put away the equipment after practice, or to ask their teacher whether they would like them to pass out supplies. In time, these kids can adopt the role of the people pleaser and overestimate its value to the overall operating of the family, school, or sports team. As children, they can be independent early on because they see their own needs as problems to avoid. Somewhere, these kids picked up the wounding message that having or expressing their own needs will lead to humiliation and rejection. They're aware of everyone's feelings and try to adapt their behavior and image to what others want. Never assume that just because a child who is a two knows your needs, that they also know their own. If a two hits a rough patch and you ask them what they need, they'll most likely say they don't know. Press them and they might become frustrated or emotional. Twos spend so much time and energy focusing on the needs of others that they lose touch with their own. By the time they reach adulthood, that is the pattern of their lives. Twos in relationships. If you're fortunate enough to have a two in your life, then you know relationships mean everything to them. I mean everything. Of all the numbers on the Enneagram, twos are the most interpersonal. Warm and tactile, they easily move toward other people. For example, Suzanne can't walk past someone she knows without touching them on the arm, patting them on the back, or stopping to take their face into her hands so she can look them in the eye and say something like, "Now you know I love you, right?" But it's important for twos to know we love them as well. They feel things deeply, and it's easy for them to express emotions. What you might not know is that most of the feelings twos have are not their own. Twos feel what you're feeling. It doesn't take long for the children of a two to figure out that mom or dad feels their feelings more than their own. But once they do, it's like they're playing poker with house money. All three of the numbers in the heart or feeling triad are hunting for a sense of personal identity. One way twos attempt to establish identity is by identifying and seeing themselves through the lens of their relationships. So rather than introducing themselves by their own name, They focus on their relationship to people you might know. It's always, "Hi, I'm Amy's husband," or "I'm Jack's mother." Twos need to learn how to individuate, to become their own person. For twos, this journey often begins in midlife when, after years of putting everyone else's needs ahead of their own, they become exhausted. One day they wake up and realize, "I can't go on giving this much. I need to take better care of myself." This is a difficult but necessary passage for twos, as well as for the people who have grown accustomed to the way they put others first and pressure them to go back to the good old days when the unaware two put everyone else's interests ahead of their own. When the time comes, it's important for others to encourage twos to become their own people who care for themselves appropriately. Twos at work. In professional life, twos often play second in command, but this doesn't feel demeaning to them. They know sergeants run armies, not generals, so they're more than happy to be the power behind the throne. When I was in elementary school, the principal's secretary was a kind, energetic, and warm-hearted woman named Miss Parker. Miss Parker sat in the main office, where she answered the endless stream of phone calls, calmed over-caffeinated, irate mothers, let us take fistfuls of M&Ms from a bowl on her desk when we received good test grades, made sure the students with peanut allergies brought their EpiPens to school, encouraged frazzled teachers, and at 3 o'clock, put on an orange vest and monitored after-school pickup. If you needed love, lunch money, or an emergency organ transplant at my elementary school, you went to Miss Parker. I'm sure the principal was a good guy, but I don't even remember his name. Twos are intuitive people with highly developed interpersonal skills who need to work in positions where there's lots of people contact. Twos build community. They know who's doing well around the office and who isn't. They remember people's birthdays and the names of everyone's kids. First to get the inside scoop, they know the backstory to everyone's divorce, whose kids need rehab, and who's pregnant before anyone else does, like even the father. As leaders, they know how to recruit the right people to accomplish a task and use encouragement and praise to inspire and motivate them. They're empathic, optimistic, and because they're image conscious, they know how to make an organization shine in the eyes of the outside world. Supervisors need to have the freedom to provide constructive feedback when their employees need it. People who supervise twos, however, should keep in mind that too much criticism or harsh words will crush them. Twos aren't as interested as other types in climbing the ladder. Or if they are, they keep their desire for recognition and attention outside their awareness because admitting they want it makes them vulnerable to disappointment. The catch about not looking a gift horse in the mouth is that it may be a Trojan horse. David Seller. Contrary to popular belief, there are plenty of male twos in the world. After 35 years of working on Wall Street, my friend Jamie founded an organization and yearly conference that brings promising young leaders together with older, accomplished leaders in the hope that they will form friendships and mentor one another. His two personality shows itself in his passion for connecting people with one another and coaching younger folks on the ways they can avoid the pitfalls commonly associated with early career success. Wings. So let's talk about twos with a one wing. Twos with a one wing are concerned about doing things properly. They want to be seen as dependable and responsible. With a one wing, these helpers are more critical of themselves, more controlling, and more prone to guilt. These twos have clearer boundaries and are more aware of their emotional needs, but still have more trouble expressing them than others. They are less trusting and expect a bit more in return for their efforts. Now, twos with a three wing are more ambitious, image conscious and competitive. Extroverted and sometimes seductive like the three, the performer, they are more concerned about relationships and connections than twos with a one wing. These twos are more confident, so they achieve more, being seen as successful is a close second to being known as loving and generous. In this space, twos with a strong self-image can shape-shift like threes to become whatever is called for to achieve the desired results. Stress and security. Twos in stress take on the characteristic behaviors of an unhealthy eight, where they become demanding and controlling, either directly or manipulatively. They blame other people for what makes them unhappy and can be surprisingly aggressive and vengeful about past wrongs. But when they're feeling secure, twos move to the healthy side of four, where they're okay with not having to pretend they love everybody. These twos have some understanding of the need for self-care and can focus inward where they invest in themselves by doing creative things which brings them joy. This is the place twos can imagine feeling good about themselves when they aren't helping someone else. Spiritual transformation. As is the case with every number, what's great about twos is what's not so great about twos. When people give too much, help for the wrong reasons, or serve others for selfish reasons rather than because they're called by God, their giving becomes calculating, controlling, and manipulative. If you're a helper, this chapter has likely been a difficult read for you. Twos have long been afraid that people will reject them once they discover the twos have needs and unattended sorrows of their own. Twos live in service to the lie that the only way to win love is through hiding the screwed-up, vulnerable people they really are behind the appearance and activity of a cheerful, selfless helper. Like all numbers in the feeling triad, they believe that if they show their true selves to the world, it will lead to rejection. The healing message for twos is, you're wanted. Twos' needs matter, and they can begin now to learn how to directly express their real feelings and desires without undue fear of humiliation or rejection. All twos have to learn the difference between self-interested and altruistic giving. Self-interested giving expects payback, whereas altruistic giving comes without any strings attached. As the saying goes, when you give and expect a return, that's an investment. When you give and don't expect anything back, that's love. Thankfully, with a little self-knowledge and self-awareness, twos can learn to give to others free of charge. If you're a two, that means you give exactly what's yours to give, nothing more and nothing less. So if your friend Isabel is buried at work and you babysit her kids, but she doesn't reciprocate when you're in a similar crisis, then it won't matter to you because you had no expectation she would. As my AA sponsor reminds me, expectations are resentments waiting to happen. Now, think back to my friend Jim from the beginning of this chapter. He didn't want, need, or ask for Gloria's help. In fact, her quote-unquote help turned out to be anything but. How differently that story would have ended if a more self-aware version of Gloria had gone to Jim and said something like, Jim, the other day at the stoplight, I noticed your car looked like it might be on its last legs. And for some reason, God has given me more money than I need, and I'd be happy to sit down with you and Karen to see if there's a way I can help. There's no pressure. Just let me know if you need a hand. It's a hackneyed story, but twos might find it helpful to read the story of Martha and Mary in Luke 10. The account begins with the words, As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. Now, isn't it interesting that it was both Martha and Mary's home, but only Martha gets credit for inviting Jesus and the disciples to come visit them? Like, was Mary inhospitable? Or of the two sisters, was it only Martha who felt compelled to meet the needs of Jesus and the disciples? So when Jesus and his friends arrive, Martha does what any good two would do, which is set to work making sure everyone is comfortable and has what they need. She has probably already washed Jesus' feet, and now she's running around to the point of distraction, making dinner while her good-for-nothing sister Mary is chilling at Jesus' feet. Martha starts feeling jealous and resentful. Everyone else is in the living room, throwing back olives and laughing while she's working her butt off in the kitchen cooking a lamb. Martha gets angry because, as usual, she is doing all the heavy lifting. And she says to Jesus, "Are you just going to let her sit here while I do all the work? Tell her to help me." I'm not sure, but I think this is the only place in the Bible where someone actually orders God to do something. Like I said, hell hath no fury like an overworked two who is feeling unappreciated. Jesus knows what's really going on and replies, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things, but few things are needed, or indeed only one. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." For twos, the lesson is simple. Sometimes you think you're serving God or other people when you're actually not. Sometimes all the doing and caretaking is not what God is calling you to do. The Bible never tells us that Martha asked Jesus what he wanted. She took it on herself to make a big to-do. Maybe God simply wants twos and all of us to relax in his presence. So here's something I learned from Enneagram teacher Helen Palmer. If twos are going to learn how to attend to their own needs as much as they pay attention to the needs of other people, they have to work on their soul in solitude. If they try to do this work in community, they'll be tempted to help those around them grow spiritually rather than focus on their own development. In this situation, the two's tendency to drop everything to help people in crisis is more a defense against facing their own needs and feelings than an act of service. In their time with God, they might ask themselves, "Who am I when no one needs me?" 10 Paths to Transformation for Twos. 1. Rather than hinting at your needs or leaving it to others to figure them out, try telling them directly. 2. Internally take a deep breath and start over when you catch yourself trying too hard to present a likable image or flattering others to win their approval. 3. Don't reflexively say yes to everything. When someone asks for your help, say you'll get back to them with an answer once you've had time to think about it. Or just experiment with saying the word no. It's a complete sentence. 4. When the urge to rescue or help overwhelms you, ask yourself, "Is this mine to do?" If you're not sure, talk it over with a trusted friend. 5. When you realize you've fallen back into the typical behaviors of your number, gently ask yourself, "What would I have to feel if I wasn't flattering or meeting this person's needs right now?" 6. Whenever possible, perform acts of anonymous service. 7. Twos toggle back and forth between having overly inflated and overly deflated views of themselves and their value to others. Remind yourself you're neither the best nor the worst, just you. 8. Don't push away feelings of resentment or entitlement when they arise. Instead, view them as invitations to look inwardly with kindness and ask, what most needs attention in my life right now? 9. Don't beat yourself up when you catch yourself moving too aggressively toward others or overwhelming them with your emotions. Congratulate yourself for spotting it and then dial it back. And finally, 10. 2 or 3 times a day, ask yourself, what am I feeling right now? And what do I need right now? Don't worry if you can't supply an answer. It takes time to develop self-care muscles. Chapter 7, Type 3, The Performer. The real question is, can you love the real me? Not that image you had of me, but who I really am. Christine Feehan. Here's a couple of statements, threes might use to describe themselves. 1. It's important for me to come across as a winner. 2. I love walking in a room and knowing I'm making a great first impression on the crowd. 3. I could persuade Bill Gates to buy a Mac. 4. The keys to my happiness are efficiency, productivity, and being acknowledged as the best. 5. I don't like it when people slow me down. 6. I know how to airbrush failure so it looks like success. 7. I'd rather lead than follow any day. 8. I am competitive to a fault. 9. I can find a way to win over and connect with just about anyone. 10. I'm a world champion multitasker. 11. I keep a close watch on how people are responding to me in the moment. 12. It's hard for me to not take work along on vacation. 13. It's hard for me to name or access my feelings. 14. I'm not one to talk much about my personal life. 15. Sometimes I feel like a phony. 16. I love setting and accomplishing measurable goals. 17. I like other people to know about my accomplishments. 18. I like to be seen in the company of successful people. 19. I don't mind cutting corners if it gets the job done more efficiently. 20. People say I don't know how or when to stop working. When threes are in a healthy space, they've transcended the goal of merely looking good and are moving toward being known and loved for who they are, not for what they accomplish. They still love to set goals, you know, rise to challenges and solve problems, but their self-worth is not tied to those things. They try to balance their abundant energy between work, rest, and some kind of contemplative prayer practice, recognizing the importance of being instead of doing. They feel valuable, which unleashes a tender benevolence that is focused on the common good. Now, average threes push achieving to overachieving, spending too much time at work or the gym. Highly driven, their need to perform even extends to the time they spend coaching the kids' soccer team or volunteering at church. They see love as something to be earned, so they quiet their inner convictions, valuing what others define as success and striving to do more and to do it better. They are confident in their abilities, but also image conscious, constantly worrying that a poor performance will cause them to lose standing in other people's eyes. Now, unhealthy threes, these folks find failure unacceptable, and it renders them unable to admit mistakes and causes them to behave as though they are superior to others. Desperate for attention, These threes may turn the deadly sin of self-deceit into the sin of intentional deceit. Telling others fabricated stories about themselves and their accomplishments in order to maintain their image. At their worst, unhealthy threes can be petty, mean, and vengeful. I grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, home to many of the most successful hedge fund managers, venture capitalists, and investment bankers in the world. There are more threes who live in Greenwich than child actors in rehab. Chief among them was my father. Like all threes, my father believed he could only be loved by being or appearing to be successful, avoiding failure at all costs, and matching his image to please a crowd. For a number of years, he had a glamorous, high-visibility career in film and television as managing director of Columbia Screen Gems Motion Pictures in Europe and the Middle East, until at age 40, he lost everything through a series of terrible personal and professional decisions. In regard to his career, my dad was a failure, but you'd never have known it from looking at him or listening to him. Even when our family was financially on the ropes, my father continued buying handmade suits from Jermyn Street in London, drove a pricey, albeit second-hand, British sports car, and managed to be the only person I know who could pull off wearing a cravat. He'd tell people stories about how Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner performed comedy sketches in our living room when we lived in London, about going on safaris with William Holden, and how the actor Roger Moore, who played James Bond, had my father to thank for his career. Now, every story was kind of true, but embellished, and he made it sound like they'd all happened in the last month, not a decade earlier. My dad believed well-heeled Greenwich folks only really value people who are accomplished, wealthy, sophisticated, and well-connected. So he morphed